idea of self-determination in the spirit in which, of course, it is intended that this is something that the Negro people decide for themselves. But they decided what the Negro people wanted and needed and told them what they should get. Now, if you have read the assignment in the documents on the Negro struggle, the discussion that took place between Trotsky and Swapik in 1933, you will find there the beginnings of the Marxist position on the question held by the SWP. That discussion revolved around the attitude that the leaders of our movement in America had toward the way in which the Communist Party was putting forward its slogan about the Negro Republic in the Black Belt. And Trotsky utilized the occasion of this discussion in order to put forward the idea that the principle of self-determination
does apply to the Negro people in the United States, even though the Communist Party had put it forward in a wrong way. And there he expressed the opinion that it was the duty of Marxists in the United States to support the right of the Negro people to separate from this country, to create a nation of their own, if they wish to. And that if they wish to, when they wish to, it would be the duty of the Marxists to support them completely in this struggle. We support the right of the Negro people to determine their own destiny, to separate from this nation if they wish to remain in this nation if they wish to, that the decision is theirs to make, and that we have the obligation to support whatever decision they make on this point. Trotsky thought and said that the fact that the Negroes had not yet raised such a demand was not evidence that they never would. He believed that they had not yet entered a profoundly nationalist stage because they did not yet see the possibility of winning freedom from the oppressors. That's a thought the time might come when the Negro people would be aroused to a desire for a state of their own, would enter a nationalist period. And he considered various possible conditions that might stimulate such a development. The party did not develop a position immediately after this discussion. These ideas were to some of our members rather startling. They were not sure that Trotsky's thinking on this question was really applicable to the situation in the United States. If you've read that discussion, you see that he is talking about a different period than today. That was before the CIO was organized. But you'll also see that a great deal of what he says there about the nature of oppression of the Negro people is still valid. Anyhow, the SWP was organized in 1938, and at its second convention in 1939, the question of adopting a position on the Negro struggle came before the delegates to that convention. And prior to that, in preparation for that convention and for a discussion of resolutions on this question at that convention, a delegation headed by J.R. Johnson went to Mexico and met with Trotsky to discuss the question again. And this time, more concretely. And the result, that discussion is also printed in the documents of the Negro Struggle. And as a result of that discussion, a few months later, the resolution was introduced at the party convention in 1939, that's 25 years ago, in which we adopted our first and our basic position on the Negro struggle. And in it, we, for the first time, adopted the view that not only that Negro nationalism is progressive, but also that a period might come when the Negro in the United States might want to separate, and that it would be our duty to support them in their efforts to separate when they did so. That in the meantime, we did not advocate that they separate. We said the decision is up to them. We are not going to tell them that we think they should separate or that they should not separate. The decision is theirs. The obligation for us is to support whatever decision they make. Now, at that time in 1939, the nationalist trends among the Negro people were very small, scattered, weak, isolated. We adopted this position, but in the subsequent years between 1939 and the 1960s, there was little that occurred which excited our interest in the question of self-determination. The major thrust of the Negro people was to knock down all of the Jim Crow walls that existed in this country during that period, to try to integrate, to use a rather indefinite word. And there was very little interest in separatism, in separate organization, or in the possibility of a separate nation. However, in the late 1950s, a number of important influences came together. First of all, there was the failure of the government to carry out the Supreme Court school decision against segregation, and the reaction among Negroes who had hoped that the government finally would do something along these lines. Combined with what was going on internationally, the fact that in large parts of the world, colored people were beginning to overthrow their white oppressors to drive them out and to obtain their freedom. These influences began to come together, and the feeling began to develop among an important part of the Negro people that as things were, they were never going to get their freedom in this lifetime, if ever, in this country, along the paths that had been followed up until then. And then began a serious rise in what we can call black nationalism. The feeling, on the one hand, that Negroes must control their own movement, that is, must have their independent or separate organizations, that these organizations must be responsible to them and not to anyone else. This was one manifestation of the nationalist mood. At another end was a growing manifestation of the idea that not only must we have separate organizations, our own leadership, our own program, and so on, but also that it is impossible, it will be always impossible to achieve equality in this society. We have to break from this society. And some say, create a separate nation of our own. Others say, go back to Africa. But we have to put an end to our inequality in this country, which will never be ended by remaining here. We have to separate. Those are the two sides of what is called nationalism. And since then, this spirit has been growing in the United States. It becomes more and more important. Now, there seems to be some confusion, even among our own members, as to what our position is. I understand one of our comrades recently was arguing in the kitchen with somebody and saying, but the SWP stands for integration. We stand for integration. And the person with whom she was arguing said, well, I didn't understand it that way. I didn't understand that you stand for integration. CORE stands for integration. The NAACP stands for integration. The Democratic Party stands for integration. But I thought that the SWP position was different. And she said, no, that's absolutely clear. We stand for integration. Now, there's a problem of definition. There's a problem of definition. What do you mean? It used to be everybody knew what was meant by integration, but now there are many different definitions of it, many different ideas about what is meant. And you have to be very clear about what you're talking about. Are you talking about integration into American capitalist society? Do you think that that is possible? Do you think that equality can be achieved within the capitalist society? Is that what you're advocating? Is that what you believe is possible? Or by integration, do you mean only knocking down every single Jim Crow restriction that exists? Merely removing all of the discriminatory barriers to Negro equality, without necessarily implying that integration, genuine equality, is possible within this society. Now we have to be very clear what we're talking about, what we mean. Now, in one sense, the SWP is for integration. That is, we are in favor of ending every Jim Crow law, practice, and custom. We are in favor of doing that now. We'll be in favor of doing it 10 years from now. We'll always be in favor of it under capitalism or after capitalism. We're in favor of that. But that doesn't mean that we think that equality can be achieved under capitalism, which is what most people mean when they talk about integration. Most people who talk about integration mean that it can be achieved eventually, gradually, by militant methods, by peaceful methods, by violent methods, by that it can be achieved in this society. But we don't think that. We don't stand for the kind of integration that is possible in capitalism. We stand for ending every restriction, but we don't believe, and we don't try to convince anybody that equality is possible under this system. Now, we will be in favor of ending all of these restrictions even if the Negroes decide to leave this country. Suppose out of 20 million Negroes in this country, 90,990,000 decide we're going to break out and leave and have a nation of our own. And they do it. And only 10,000 say are left in the entire United States. we would still be in favor of ending every restriction. In that sense, you'd say we're in favor of integration. But not in the sense that we are in favor of integration in the belief that capitalism can provide equality. And when a Negro worker listens to us, we have to make clear what we mean, so that we can be in favor of the separation of the Negro people, if that is what they determine that they want, and at the same time be in favor of ending all of the restrictions that remain in whatever is left of the United States after they go out. All right, so the right of self-determination means the right of the Negro people to decide how they want to live. Do they want to live in the United States, or do they want to be in a country of their own? That's the right of self-determination, the right to make that decision. And the duty of a revolutionary Marxist is to support the Negroes in whatever decision they make, and to fight with them to help them achieve whatever they want. Because if they decide for separation, that's not going to be a very easy thing to accomplish. That's going to require revolutionary struggle, because the capitalists are not about to give up any part of their country. That would require a revolutionary struggle. Just as revolutionary a struggle as it will be to end capitalism in the United States, which is the other way in which Negroes can win equality, by ending this system. But both require a revolution. Both are very difficult. And we support both. We may return to the question of self-determination at our next class, but that's about all I'm going to say on it now. What I want to take up next is the question which Harold Cruz deals with in his article, right at the very beginning of his article. I don't know if any of you have that with you, but it's in the very second paragraph of the first of his two articles. Toward the end of the middle of the second paragraph, he says, "The theory and practice of revolutionary Marxism in America is based on the assumption that white labor, both organized and unorganized, must be a radical anti-capitalist force in America, and must form an alliance," in quotes, "with Negroes for the liberation of both labor and the Negro from capitalist exploitation." Cruz takes the position that when we speak about a future radicalization of the American white workers, we're just living in a dream world. That it cannot happen. There was a period when labor was radical in the 1930s, but that has finished. That's gone. He says, that's gone forever. White workers have become conservative, pro-capitalist, and hostile or indifferent to the Negroes. There was a time, he thinks, Cruz thinks, when it was reasonable to expect that the white workers could usher in socialism, but it's too late now. The only ones capable of revolutionary action in this country are the black people, says Cruz. And then he turns and lets the Marxists have it. He says, "We are obsessed by a working class socialist myth, by this grand illusion, this white labor mystique. So much so that we've lost touch with reality. We just don't know what the world is like any longer as a result of this obsession. And then he says what the theory and practice of revolutionary Marxism in America is and must be. He says if it doesn't have this assumption, then it can't be Marxist. It means giving up Marxism. The assumption that white labor must be a radical anti-capitalist force in America and must form an alliance with Negroes. Now, if somebody says that something must be, that is, the assumption that white labor must be radical, and it obviously isn't true, then everybody concludes that that man is some kind of a nut. And everybody is right. But if he's obviously a nut, then why spend so much space and time trying to answer it? If we believe what Cruz says we must believe, that is, that white labor must be radical. Now, the truth is that the SWP does not believe that the workers must be radical and anti-capitalist. We are well aware that the overwhelming majority of white workers in this country today are not radical, thanks to capitalist brainwashing, relative prosperity, treacherous labor leadership, and political immaturity. That's one of the reasons why socialism in general and our party in particular are so weak. What we believe is not that the workers must be radical, but that they must become radical if they are to solve their problems, and that they will become radical under certain conditions and at certain times. Now, must be is quite different from must become. Marxists have never believed that the workers in capitalist countries must be or have been radical all the time. We don't idealize the workers, knowing very well and from painful experience that they can be and often are infected, corrupted, demoralized, exhausted, and disoriented. Their radicalism waxes and wanes, rises and sinks, depending on their conditions, leadership, and level of consciousness. This is about the white workers I'm talking. But isn't this also true of the Negro masses, that their radicalism is not a constant and invariable thing? The American working class has not been radical during most of its existence. And even when it was much more radical than it is today in the 1930s and the first part of the 1940s, it never reached, the white workers in this country never reached the point of breaking with the politics of the capitalists whom they were battling on the picket lines and of forming a party of their own, a non-capitalist party of their own. And the most radical sector of the working class today, which is the workers in the black ghetto, they haven't always been as radical as they are today. Socialists believe that the working class can become revolutionary. Not always, but sometimes. And that on an occasion like that, which does not occur all the time or last forever when it does occur, that the workers can, in cooperation with other non-capitalist forces and with a consistently revolutionary leadership, abolish the system that breeds racism and poverty and unemployment and war and so on. The question of leadership is crucial precisely because such revolutionary opportunities do not knock at the door often or keep knocking for long, and a leadership must be ready on those rare occasions to take advantage of them, or they go by with the advantage not taken. Our assumption, therefore, unlike the one that Cruz imputes to us, is not that the working class can or will be radical all of the time or most of the time, but that the conditions created by capitalism must radicalize them some of the time. And that even though revolutionary situations occur rarely, one revolutionary situation can be turned into a successful revolution. As the Cuban experience demonstrates, a successful conquest of power can then quickly alter conditions enough so that the revolutionary consciousness and will of most of the workers will remain high and can become permanent, which is not possible under capitalism. Now, Cruz does not consider such a working class revolution possible, like most Americans, or even like some of the new left spokesmen, like the late Professor C. Wright Mills. Together with other sophisticated opponents of Marxism, Cruz lives in a world that is changing with dizzying speed. But he thinks everything is going to change except the workers. Talk about a grand illusion. Even the most ignorant capitalist knows better than that. The future of this country will be determined in large part by the relations among its three major forces: the capitalists, the white workers, and the Negroes, who are mostly workers too. At present, the capitalists dominate and have the support of most white workers. Cruz thinks this is going to last forever. It won't, because of the internal contradictions of this system. The central contradiction is the material readiness of our society for socialism and the ideological and political unreadiness of the white workers to fight for it. Tied up with this is another acute contradiction: the readiness of the Negroes to fight for jobs and justice with the most militant means, and the unreadiness of organized labor and the white workers as a whole to support the black people. From our analysis of the social structure, we conclude that the contradiction prevailing between white workers and Negroes is not absolute, but relative, is not permanent, but transitory. The alienation between them, between the white workers and the Negroes, is no more enduring than the political and ideological partnership between the white workers and their bosses. In fact, these two states are interconnected. Any deepening of antagonism between the white workers and the ruling class, any cutting of ties between them, any opening or widening of breaches between them, between the white workers and the capitalists, objectively sets the stage for a lessening of the antagonism and a narrowing of the gap between the Negro movement and the white workers. The outlook of the white workers is going to be altered from two directions. One is from the independent struggle of the Negroes, which tends to upset the status quo and introduce unsettling elements into class relations. The disrupted patterns of politics in this election year testify to the power of the independent Negro struggle to disarrange and overturn customary modes of thought and action. Is there any reason to think that white workers will not also be shaken up and divided, and some of them torn out of their ruts as the Negro struggle continues to develop and explode? The other, the second and more basic modifying factor, comes directly from the operation of the capitalist system itself. In the next decade, automation will create vast armies of unemployed and undermine the security of all workers, even those of high seniority, skill, and privilege, that is, mostly white workers. America's share of the world market will continue to be shrunk by the colonial revolution on one side and by growing competition from other capitalist countries on the other, and this will drive the capitalists to attack the wage rates and living standards of the employed workers. Isn't this certain to provoke anti-capitalist sentiments and attitudes, not only among the youth and the unemployed, but also among unionists still on the job? Won't such radicalization make white workers more susceptible to suggestions for joint action with the Negro movement? Won't the possibility be opened for a change in the present situation, for united action by the two anti-capitalist movements against the upholders of the system responsible for their common insecurity? We hope that what I've just said will not be distorted. It is a perspective to be worked for, not an existing reality. We do not think that the achievement of joint action between the Negro people and the white workers will be easy or quick. We are not suggesting that the Negro should wait until the white workers are ready for collaboration, until they build their own movement with its own leaders, ideology, and program. We are not proposing, and we don't favor any alliance where the white workers call the shots and the Negroes comply. We are talking about an alliance of equals, an alliance with radicalized, not conservatized, white workers, an alliance against all capitalist parties, not behind the Democratic Party. Therefore, what we are talking about is the future, which may be less distant than it appears now to some of us. We're talking about the future and not about today. We concur 100% with the decision of militant Negroes to concentrate on building their own movement and working out tactics based, first of all, on the situation as it is today, where there is no real unity with white workers. A correct overall strategy has to take into account, however, that the situation will not remain as it is today for the reasons which I've already cited. A correct overall strategy has to include that in it, too, that things are going to change. And the Negro movement, therefore, has to be prepared for the changes that are coming and help to promote them, because they'll be to the benefit of Negroes as well as white workers. In our 1963 convention resolution, Freedom Now, we stated that the first stage of the alliance, of the coming alliance, that we foresee and predict, will probably be the knitting of ties between the black vanguard and the revolutionary socialist vanguard. Not an immediate coming together of the two movements, the whole Negro movement and the whole working class movement, but in the first stages there'll be a coming together of the vanguards, the radical vanguard of the black movement and the vanguard, the revolutionary socialist vanguard in and around the SWP. We continue to seek such ties. We are on the side of the Negroes wherever they clash with prejudiced and privileged white workers. We support and work with black radicals even though they have crossed off the white workers forever as any help to their struggle. We will work with black radicals and black nationalists, even though they believe that the white workers will never change. We don't feel that there's any inconsistency in doing this, because we are confident that their own experience will teach them, as it will teach the white workers, that collaboration between both camps is ultimately indispensable if the power structure in this country is not just to be shaken up or renovated, but actually toppled. Experience will prove that the monopolists cannot be dislodged from their seats of power except by a transformation of the relations between the three main forces. A dialectical transformation of the capitalist white worker partnership into its opposite, a Negro white worker alliance against the capitalist regime. So that's what I would say in part about the point which Cruz makes in his article about the basic assumption of Marxism in America, and also about the question of what will happen to the white workers in the years to come, what the prospects are for unity between them and the Negro movement, about an alliance, and what kind of an alliance will be possible. There are a number of ways in which Cruz's article misrepresents the position of the Socialist Workers' Party. I hope you noticed that, just to take in a small example, misrepresents Marx's position entirely, not only the SWP. Did you notice that in his articles, he twice makes use of the remark that he attributes to Marx, that I am not a Marxist. You notice he does this not once, but twice, and he accepts it as good coin and repeats it. Marx said, I am not a Marxist. Then what the hell are other people saying that they're Marxist for? They got even less right to say I am a Marxist, is the view that Cruz takes. Now, what is the fact about this quotation? What does it mean? What are the circumstances under which it was made? In the first place, this is from a letter, not by Marx, but by Engels, written in 1890, some 7 years after Marx's death. And Engels is writing a letter to somebody by the name of Conrad Schmidt. And in his letter, he discusses a book that has been written by somebody dealing with historical development, and maybe even historical materialism. And the only thing that Engels knows about the book is what has been written in a review of the book by a man named Moritz Wirth, whom he doesn't think much of, Moritz Wirth. That is, he's not ready to accept Moritz Wirth's evaluation of this book that he hasn't read, because he doesn't have much confidence in Moritz Wirth's opinion. So he says, little Moritz is a dangerous friend. The materialist conception of history has a lot of them nowadays, to whom it serves as an excuse for not studying history. This was Engels' complaint against a lot of people who picked up historical materialism as a fad, and he said instead of using it to investigate history, they use it as a reason not to study history, merely to make abstractions. So Engels says, to whom it serves as an excuse for not studying history, just as Marx used to say, commenting on the French quote Marxist unquote of the late 70s, All I know is that I am not a Marxist. In other words, if they are Marxists, these French Marxists, in quote, if they are Marxists, then all I know is that I'm not a Marxist. So that the intention of the thing, of the quotation, is not that Marx was not a Marxist, or that there can be no such thing as a Marxist, which is what Cruz seems to say, but rather the opposite, that Marx did not consider himself that kind of so-called Marxist. Now let's take up a few other of Cruz's allegations. Cruz says that the growing independence of the Negro movement produces a crisis for Marxists. He says this over and over again in the article. That's the theme. He says, the greater the Negro movement becomes as an independent force, I'm quoting now, the deeper does the crisis become for the Marxist movement itself. For the alliance, in quote, it attempts to forge with the Negro must be one where the Marxists dominate. End of quotation. In other words, we are opposed to the Negro movement being really independent. The more independent it becomes, the worse, the less we like it, and the more of a crisis we are flung into. Because the only kind of relations we want with the Negro movement are where we will dominate it. We Marxists will dominate it. Now, the facts, fortunately, are readily available. And the record bulges with facts that refute Cruz's claim that the SWP is opposed to the independence of the Negro movement. To the independence of the Negro movement from the labor movement or from anything else, including the SWP. Throughout its entire existence, the SWP has thought, said, and argued just the opposite. It was the first radical organization in this country to assert the correctness and necessity of Negro independence. In the resolution I referred to before, as long ago as 1939, when the SWP was a year old, we said in a unanimously adopted resolution, "The awakening political consciousness of the Negro, not unnaturally, takes the form of a desire for independent action uncontrolled by whites. The Negroes have long felt, and more than ever feel today, the urge to create their own organizations under their own leaders, and thus assert, not only in theory, but in action, their claim to complete equality with other American citizens. Such a desire is legitimate and must be vigorously supported." That's what we said 25 years ago. And we've never wavered in this position once throughout those 25 years. What we said just a year ago in our convention resolution was, "The liberation of the Negro people requires that the Negroes organize themselves independently and control their own struggle, and not permit it to be subordinated to any other consideration or interest." Now, you can't speak any more plainly than that. And it's pretty hard for anybody to say that the SWP is not in favor of an independent Negro movement, unless everything we've been saying throughout our entire life is the opposite of what we believe from the first year to the 26th. And that would be a strange way for a political party to proceed.